35. The morning was misty and cool. Thick swirls of fog blew through the ruined streets, fog so heavy that Sheeran was unable to tell which suns were in the sky. Onos, certainly, somewhere, but its golden light was diffused and almost completely concealed by the fog. And that patch of slightly brighter sky off to the southwest very likely indicated the presence of one of the pairs of twin suns. But whether they were Sitha and Tano or Patru and Trey, he had no way of discerning. He was very tired. It was already abundantly clear to him that his notion of making his way alone and on foot across the hundreds of miles between Saro City and Amgondo National Park was an absurd fantasy. Damn, Theremin. Together, at least, they might have stood a chance. But the newspaper man had been unshakable in his confidence that he would somehow find Sephira in the forest. Talk about fantasy. Talk about absurdity. Sheeran stared ahead, peering through the fog. He needed a place to rest for a while. He needed to find something fit to eat, and perhaps a change of clothing or at least a way of bathing himself. He had never been this filthy in his life, or as hungry, or as weary, or as despondent. Through the whole long episode of the coming of the darkness, from the first moment that he had heard from Binet and Aethor that such a thing was likely, Sheeran had bounced around from one end of the psychological spectrum to the other, from pessimism to optimism and back again, from hope to despair to hope. His intelligence and experience told him one thing. His naturally resilient personality told him another. Perhaps Binet and Aethor were wrong and the astronomical cataclysm wouldn't happen at all. No, the cataclysm will definitely happen. Darkness, despite his own disturbing experiences with it at the Tunnel of Mystery 2 years before, would turn out not to be such a troublesome thing after all, if indeed it did come. Wrong. Darkness will cause universal madness. The madness would be only temporary, a brief period of disorientation. The madness will be permanent in most people. The world would be disrupted for a few hours and then go back to normal. The world will be destroyed in the chaos following the eclipse. Back and forth, up and down, twin Sheerans locked in endless debate. But now he had hit the bottom of the cycle, and he seemed to be staying there, unmoving and miserable. His resilience and optimism had evaporated in the glare of what he had seen during his wanderings these past few days. It would be decades, possibly even a century or more, before things returned to normal. The mental trauma had scored too deep a scar. The destruction that had already occurred to the fabric of society was too widespread. The world he had loved had been vanquished by darkness and smashed beyond repair. That was his professional opinion, and he could see no reason to doubt it. This was the third day now since Sheeran had parted from Theremin in the forest and gone marching off in his usual jaunty fashion toward Amgondo. That jauntiness was hard to recapture now. He had managed to get out of the forest in one piece. There had been a couple of bad moments, times when he had had to wave his hatchet around and look menacing and lethal, a total bluff on his part, but it had worked. And for the last day or so, he had been moving in a plodding way through the once pleasant southern suburbs. Everything was burned out around here. Entire neighborhoods had been destroyed and abandoned. Many of the buildings were still smoldering. The main highway running to the southern provinces, Sheeran had believed, began just a few miles below the park, a couple of minutes' drive if you were driving. But he wasn't driving. He had had to make the horrendous climb up out of the forest to the imposing hill that was Onos Heights, practically on his hands and knees, clawing his way through the underbrush. It took him half a day just to ascend those few hundred yards. Once he was on top, Sheeran saw that the hill was more like a plateau, but it stretched on endlessly before him, and though he walked and walked and walked, he did not come to the highway. Was he going the right way? Yes. Yes, from time to time he saw a road sign at a street corner that told him he was indeed heading toward the Great Southern Highway. How far was it, though? The signs didn't say. Every 10 or 12 blocks there was another sign, that was all. He kept going. He had no choice. But reaching the highway was only the first step in getting to Amgondo. He would still be in Saro City, essentially, at that point. Then what? Keep on walking? What else? He could hardly hitch a ride with someone. No vehicles seemed to be running anywhere. The public fuel stations must have gone dry days ago, those that had not been burned. How long was it likely to take him, at this pace, to get down to Amgondo on foot? Weeks? Months? No, it would take him forever. He'd be dead of starvation long before he came anywhere near the place. Even so, he had to go on. Without a sense of purpose, he was finished right now, and he knew it. Something like a week had passed since the eclipse, maybe more. He was beginning to lose track of time. He neither ate regularly nor slept regularly anymore, and Sheeran had always been a man of the most punctual habits. Suns came and went in the sky now, the light brightened or dimmed, the air grew warmer or cooler, and time passed. But without the progression of breakfast, lunch, dinner, sleep, Sheeran had no idea of how it was passing. He knew only that he was rapidly running out of strength. He hadn't eaten properly since the coming of the nightfall. From that dark moment onward, it had been scraps and shards for him, nothing more. A bit of fruit from some tree when he could find it. Any unripe seeds that didn't look as though they'd be poisonous. Blades of grass. Anything. It wasn't making him sick somehow, but it wasn't sustaining him very well either. The nutritional content must have been close to zero. His clothes, worn and tattered, hung from him like a shroud. He didn't dare look underneath them. He imagined that his skin must lie now in loose folds over his jutting bones. His throat was dry all the time. His tongue seemed swollen. There was a frightful pounding behind his eyes, and that dull, numb, hollow sensation in his gut all the time. Well, he told himself in his more cheerful moments, there must have been some reason why he had devoted himself so assiduously for so many years to building up such an opulent layer of fat, and now he was learning what that reason was. But his cheerful moments were fewer and farther between every day. Hunger was preying on his spirits, and he realized that he couldn't hold out much longer like this. His body was big. It was accustomed to regular feedings and robust ones. He could live only so long on his accumulated backlog of Sheeran, and then he would be too weak to pull himself onward. Before long, it would seem simpler just to curl up behind some bush and rest, and rest, and rest. He had to find food. Soon. The neighborhood he was moving through now, though deserted like all the rest, seemed a little less devastated than the areas behind him. There had been fires here, too, but not everywhere, and the flames appeared to have jumped randomly past this house and that without harming them. Patiently, Sheeran went from one to the next, trying the door of each house that didn't seem to have been seriously damaged. Locked. Every one of them. How fastidious of these people, he thought. How tidy. The world has fallen in around their ears, and they're abandoning their homes in blind terror, running off to the forest, the campus, the city, the gods only knew where, and they take the trouble to lock their houses before they go. As if they mean simply to have a brief holiday during the time of chaos, and then go home to their books and their bric-a-brac, their closets full of nice clothing, their gardens, their patios. Or hadn't they realized that everything was over, that the chaos was going to go on and on and on? Perhaps, Sheeran thought dismally, they aren't gone at all. They're in there, hiding behind those locked doors of theirs, huddling in the basement the way I did, waiting for things to get normal again. Or else staring at me from the upstairs windows, hoping I'll go away. He tried another door. Another. Another. All locked. No response.
Hey, anybody home? Let me in.
Silence. He stared bleakly at the thick wooden door in front of him. He envisioned the treasures behind it, the food not yet spoiled and waiting to be eaten, the bathtub, the soft bed. And here he was outside with no way of getting in. He felt a little like the small boy in the fable who has been given the magic key to the garden of the gods, where fountains of honey flow and gumdrops grow on every bush, but who is too small to reach up and put it in the keyhole. He felt like crying. He realized, then, that he was carrying a hatchet, and he began to laugh. Hunger must have been making him simple-minded. The little boy in the fable perseveres, offering his mittens and his boots and his velvet cap to various animals who are passing by, so that they will help him. Each one gets on another one's back, and he climbs on the top of the heap and puts the key in the keyhole. And here was not-so-little Sheeran, staring at a locked door, and he was holding a hatchet. Break the door down? Just break it down? It went against everything that he thought was right and proper. Sheeran looked at the hatchet as though it had turned to a serpent in his hand. Breaking in, why, that was burglary. How could he, Sheeran 501, professor of psychology at Sorrow University, simply smash down the door of some law-abiding citizen's house and casually help himself to whatever he found there? Easily, he told himself, laughing even harder at his own foolishness. This is how you do it. He swung the hatchet. But it wasn't all that easy. His starvation-weakened muscles rebelled at the effort. He could lift the hatchet all right, and he could swing it. But the blow seemed pathetically weak, and a line of fire shot through his arms and back as the blade made contact with the stout wooden door. Had he split the door? No. Cracked it a little? Maybe. Maybe a little chip. He swung again. Again. Harder. There you go, Sheeran. You're getting the hang of it now. Swing. Swing. He scarcely felt the pain after the first few swings. He closed his eyes, pulled breath deep into his lungs and swung. And swung again. The door was cracking now. There was a perceptible crevice. Another swing. Another. Maybe five or six more good blows and it would break in half. Food. Bath. Bed. Swing. And swing. And the door opened in his face. He was so astonished that he nearly fell through. He staggered and lurched, braced himself with the haft of the axe against the doorframe, and looked up. Half a dozen fierce, wild-eyed faces looked back at him.
"You knocked, sir?"
a man said, and everyone howled in manic glee. Then they reached out for him, caught him by his arms, and pulled him inside.
"You won't be needing this,"
someone said, and effortlessly twisted the hatchet from Sheeran's grasp.
"You can only hurt yourself with a thing like that, don't you know?"
More laughter, a crazed howling. They pushed him into the center of the room and formed a ring around him. There were seven, eight, maybe nine of them, men and women both, and one half-grown boy. Sheeran could see at a glance that they weren't the rightful residents of this house, which must have been neat and well-maintained before they moved into it. Now there were stains on the wall, half the furniture was overturned, there was a sodden puddle of something, wine, on the carpet. He knew what these people were. They were squatters, rough and ragged-looking, unshaven, unwashed. They had come drifting in, had taken possession of the place after its owners fled. One of the men was wearing only a shirt. One of the women, hardly more than a girl, was clad in just a pair of shorts. They all had an acrid, repellent odor. Their eyes had that intense, rigid, off-setter look that he had seen a thousand times in recent days. You didn't need any clinical experience to know that those were the eyes of the insane. Cutting through the stink of the squatters' bodies, though, was another odor, a much more pleasing one. One that almost drove Sheeran out of his mind, too. The aroma of cooking food. They were preparing a meal in the next room. Soup? Stew? Something was boiling in there. He swayed, dizzied by his own hunger and the sudden hope of soothing it at last. Mildly, he said, I didn't know the house was occupied, but I hope you'll let me stay with you this evening, and then I'll be moving along.
You from the patrol?
A big, heavily bearded man asked suspiciously. He seemed to be the leader. Sheeran said uncertainly,
"The patrol? No, I don't know anything about them. My name is Sheeran 501, and I'm a member of the faculty of..."
"Patrol! Patrol! Patrol!" they were chanting suddenly, moving in a circle around him.
"Sorrow University," he finished.
It was as though he had uttered a magic spell. They halted in their tracks as his quiet voice cut through their shrill screaming, and they fell silent, staring at him in a terrifying way.
"You see, you're from the university?"
the leader asked in a strange tone.
"That's right, a department of psychology. I'm a teacher, and I do a little hospital work on the side. Look, I don't intend to make any trouble for you at all. I just need a place to rest for a few hours and a little food, if you can spare it. Just a little. I haven't eaten since..."
"University!"
a woman cried. The way she said it, it sounded like something filthy, something blasphemous. Sheeran had heard that tone before from Philemon 66, the night of the eclipse, referring to scientists. It was a frightening thing to hear.
"University! University! University!"
They began to circle around him again, chanting again, pointing at him, making bizarre signs with their hooked fingers. He could no longer understand their words. It was a raucous, nightmare chant, nonsense syllables. Were these people some subchapter of the Apostles of Flame, convening here to practice an arcane rite? No, he doubted that. They had a different look. Too ragged, too shabby, too demented. The apostles, such few of them as he had seen, had always appeared crisp, self-contained, almost frighteningly controlled. Besides, the apostles hadn't been in evidence since the eclipse. Sheeran supposed that they had all withdrawn to some sanctuary of their own to enjoy the vindication of their beliefs in private. These people, he thought, were simply unaffiliated, wandering crazies. And it seemed to Sheeran that he saw murder in their eyes. "Listen," he said, "if I've disturbed some ceremony of yours in any way, I apologize, and I'm perfectly willing to leave right now. I only tried to come in here because I thought the house was empty, and I was so hungry. I didn't mean to..."
"University! University!"
He had never seen a look of such intense hatred as these people were giving him. But there was fear there, too. They kept back from him, tense, trembling as if in dread of some terrible power that he might unexpectedly unleash. Sheeran held his hands out to them imploringly. If only they'd stop prancing and chanting for a moment. The smell of the food cooking in the next room was making him wild. He caught one of the women by the arm, hoping to halt her long enough to appeal to her for a crust, a bowl of broth, anything. But she jumped away, hissing as though Sheeran had burned her with his touch, and rubbed frantically at the place on her arm where his fingers had briefly rested. "Please," he said, "I don't intend any harm. I'm as harmless as anyone there is, believe me."
"Harmless," the leader cried, spitting the word out. "You? You, university? You're worse than the patrol. The patrol just makes a little trouble for people, but you, you destroyed the world."
"I what?"
"Be careful, Tussibar," a woman said. "Get him out of here before he makes a magic on us."
"A magic?"
Sheeran said.
"Me?"
They were pointing at him again, stabbing the air vehemently, terrifyingly. Some had begun to chant under their breaths, a low, fierce chant that had the rhythms of a motor steadily gaining speed and soon to spin out of control. The girl, who wore only a pair of shorts, said,
"It was the university that called down the darkness on us."
"And the stars," said the man who just wore a shirt. "They brought the stars."
"And this one might bring them back," said the woman who had spoken before. "Get him out of here! Get him out of here!"
Sheeran stared incredulously. He told himself that he should have been able to predict this. It was an all too likely development. Pathological suspicion of all scientists, all educated people. An unreasoning phobia that must be raging now like a virus among the survivors of the night of terror.
"Do you think I can bring back the stars with a snap of my fingers? Is that what's frightening you?"
"You are university,"
the man called Tassibar said.
"You knew the secrets. University brought the darkness. Yes, university brought the stars. University brought doom."
It was too much. Bad enough to be dragged in here and forced to inhale the maddening flavor of that food without being allowed to have any of it, but to be blamed for the catastrophe, to be looked upon as some sort of malevolent witch by these people. Something snapped in Sheeran. Derisively, he cried,
"Is that what you believe? You idiots! You deranged, superstitious fools! Blaming the university? We brought the darkness? By all the gods, what stupidity! We were the very ones who tried to warn you!"
He gestured angrily, clenching his fists, clashing them furiously together.
"He's going to bring them again, Tassibar! He'll make it go dark on us! Stop him! Stop him!"
Suddenly they were clustering all about him, closing in, reaching for him. Sheeran, standing in their midst, held out his hands helplessly, apologetically toward them, and did not try to move. He regretted having insulted them just now, not because it had endangered his life, they probably hadn't even paid attention to the names he was calling them, but because he knew that the way they were was not their fault. If anything, it was his fault for not having tried harder to help them protect themselves against what he knew was coming. Those articles of pheromones, if only he had spoken with the newspaper man, if only he had urged him in time to change his mocking tack. Yes, he regretted that now. He regretted all sorts of things, things both done and undone. But it was much too late. Someone punched him. He gasped in surprise and pain.
"Lilith!"
he managed to cry. Then they swarmed all over him,